I've been to so many parenting seminars, which is all about how to change your child, to create systems that will get their behavior to shift. And the whole time I sit there, I go, what are the parents doing? How are they behaving? And the parents that are the most grounded, the parents that are the least anxious, the parents that are the most passionate, those are the parents that succeed well, because they know who they are and they're attempting to live in a certain way. The children essentially pick that up, you know.
No, you go first. You go first.
You go first.
How are you?
Okay, I need you to say, welcome to the Voices Podcast.
Welcome to the Voices Cut Podcast.
Well, hello, Voices friends. Glad to have you on for another episode today. That was my my five-year-old Jad. Thought I'd have him join us for this one very briefly to say hello, because today we're having a guest, Kevin Nooner, who's been on before, and he's talking about parenting and deconstruction, raising kids while you're going through transitions and changes and evolution in your faith. So very excited to have you listen to this episode. I think it's going to be really helpful for all of you parents out there as you're working through things and how to talk about God with your kiddos. And then those of you that you don't have kids or you don't have kids yet, I think this will be really helpful stuff as you're thinking about the future and what it might mean for you to invest in children. So before we jump into the episode, just wanted to let you know about the book clubs. Maybe you've seen it on our social media, but essentially what we're doing is we are starting the Voices Book Club. And if you become a patron at any level, that's could be as small as a dollar up to $50 a month, we will send you the first book for free and let you be a part of this exclusive little book club that Kyle and I are going to be joining you on. So the first book we're going to read is God Enters Stage Left. I actually got to write the foreword for it, so I feel pretty amazing about that. It's a book by one of our guests we've had before, Tim Day. He is up in Canada in the Toronto area and does a bunch of city development, kind of community work. And he wrote this book that is essentially the grand narrative of all of Scripture. So connecting the dots from Old Testament to New Testament and kind of helping you see that it's all one cohesive story rather than what can so often happen in the way that we read the Bible is we just cherry pick verses and we find ones and like, oh, this one applies to me and I like this one. Or maybe you find something that you're like, oh, I don't like this. And so then you just go, oh, well, scrap the whole thing. Like, screw this whole book, right? You know, like those things can happen. So what he does is he helps you understand the grand narrative of Scripture from a historical perspective and an understanding that I think will help you see the Bible for what it is rather than maybe what you've told it is, and hopefully help you have a deeper appreciation for this sacred text. So yeah, the book club is starting up. Become a patron. You can go onto our Patreon website and go to our social media. You'll see links and hear a little bit more about that. But what we're basically going to do is a couple times a month, we're just going to have this little message board kind of a thing. And we will share, Kyle and I will jump on there. We'll share some stuff that we're learning and allow you to do the same thing. And just a way for us to have this little community, Voices community, to be working through some of this stuff together. Cause I know it can feel like you're alone a lot of times as you're deconstructing, reconstructing, and reimagining faith. So I'm going to stop talking now because I know most of you just get on here because you just want to hear the speakers and authors and people. So let's jump into Parenting Through Deconstruction with Kevin Nooner of Spark Church. Here we go. Okay, so I mean that's kind of like the history of you as a child kind of growing up.
Yeah.
Now, tell us a little bit about what's your current family system, and then I'll interrupt you with a couple questions kind of along the way with this part.
Danielle and I have been married 19 years. It'll be 20 years this year. We have two daughters. It's a little bit complicated to explain because our oldest daughter is 27 and our youngest daughter is 3 3/4. She'll be 4.
23-year gap. Wow.
And people obviously have eyebrows raised. The short story is that our oldest daughter is South African. Danielle met her when she was 17 years old. She came into our lives. She moved in with us when she was 19. And there are no legal or official arrangements. South Africa doesn't have an adoption arrangement with the United States, and she was too old. So essentially, we are American benefactors, which makes us sound rich. So I don't like that term because we are so not. Anyway.
I mean, you are a pastor, so.
Yeah, and I'm still paying off those bills. Like, what's the minimum I can pay this month? Okay, great. We'll pay that.
Yeah,
this
we'll
month.
Do that.
So anyway, but she is wonderful. And she's in Vietnam teaching English, and it's just been a wonderful experience. And then we have a 3-year-old who we adopted when she was 2 weeks old, and she is an absolute joy. She's just
I just met her, and she just she has this energy. She's just so light.
Oh, yeah.
So warm. Oh, she's adorable.
Oh, she's adorbs.
Yeah.
And I'm saying this as a completely objective evaluator. She is the cutest girl in the world. Yeah. No yeah. subjectivity in there.
Yeah, not at all. No.
In fact, you're
not partial.
Yeah. Yeah. It was so funny. We took her to the doctor's appointment, I guess, a year ago. And I said, "Doctor, I need to know, is she the cutest girl in the world?" And the doctor, of course, affirmed. And I said, "Okay, I've got the doctor's statement now." So anyway, she's beautiful.
Wonderful. It's solid. Okay, so I mean that's fascinating to me. This so you have a 27-year-old and you have a 3-year-old.
Yeah.
So as it relates to what we do on this show a lot is we're deconstructing some of these widely held beliefs or ideas, worldview mm-hmm. about Christianity, and what happens for many of the people in our audience is they go through a point where there's a disruption, which that's language I've actually stolen from you. There's this point that you hit that causes you to start to ask different questions, right, have some doubts. Right. So as you kind of look back at even prior to adopting your oldest, that's the right term.
I mean, we can use it sentimentally. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
It's not like I said, nothing not legal official. Or official, but yeah.
So you have gone through a deconstruct in many ways. Did that happen prior to your oldest, or was that something that happened kind of along the way? And maybe just give us a little bit of how that even happened for you and when.
I think I've talked before on this podcast that the deconstruction journey for me has really been more a discovery than a deconstruction and a disruption. So, I mean, this could go all the way back to, my college days when I started reading the Satanic Bible, the Quran, and the Book of Mormon, just because I felt like being educated and open-minded was a value. Mm-hmm. And so because of my foray into those kinds of areas, when it comes to, I don't know if I can believe in the patriarchal hierarchy that my church believed in, it was kind of a natural way of just asking a deeper question that I had done previously. So in short, to answer to your question, the deconstruction for me, which I call a deconstructive journey and discovery, I suppose, mm-hmm. Definitely happened before the kids showed up.
Before? Okay. Yeah.
Because I've been doing this for, I guess, a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Asking questions. Being a pain in the sides of people that want to hold on to conservative anchor points. Right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's been just a whole part of even like your family system. So you and your wife have you been on this journey together?
No, I started reading things. We had a conversation early on in our marriage and she's like, "What are you reading?" And I think I've heard her mention that she had a moment of concern. Like, is Kevin still a Christian anymore?
Yeah.
Because again, we both of us had a sense of Christian meant you believe these certain things rather than just following Jesus wherever that leads you or takes you. If you don't believe these things anymore, then you're moving outside of that boundary set, right? You're outside those lines. So we had a little bit of that, but that passed quickly, because at some particular point, the scholarship, the reading, the study, the history, the sociology, these are These are just things that are true and exist. You know, everybody's Bible, unless it's dishonest, will tell you that Mark 16 and John chapter 8 doesn't belong there. I shouldn't say doesn't belong there, but it will tell you that the earliest and best manuscripts do not include these passages. So, for example, in the conversation about being inspired or inerrant or whatever, that's fine. Again, everybody has the prerogative to believe what it is that they want to believe, but that textual criticism history forces the question, which Bible is inerrant? Which passages are inspired? Which words? Which textual variant? Because Daniel Wallace, who we had at our church, who's a brilliant textual critic from Dallas Theological Seminary, will tell you we have over 400,000 textual variants in our manuscript history.
Are you serious?
400,000. So if you're going to believe in the inspired, inerrant word of God, which is fine. I don't demean anybody who has a conviction about that. It just begs the question, which Bible?
Yeah. Which one of those 400,000?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So once you learn those kinds of things, you're just forced to ask some questions. An honest seeker will be forced to ask some questions. Mm-hmm. Now, if you avoid those questions, you run the danger of creating your own religion, right? This is a slippery slope into all sorts of other problems, which is why engaging in the Voices podcast and deconstruction and asking deeper questions and being able to still engage in conversation with people who believe very different things from you, it should be a deep value. So that we avoid that pride and that kind of this has nothing to do with parenting, does it? I don't know. Are we doing okay?
Well, yeah.
I want to make sure we're on the same track that you want to be on. So,
well, I think that's helpful in the sense of just some of hearing a little bit of your process through all of this. But we do want to get into some very specific things because I feel like there. If I can just say, even from my own journey with my wife Lindsay, I think. Deconstruction kind of began, I guess, probably about 4 years ago is when I feel like it really took a turn. I think I've always been somebody that has always been like, I don't know about that. And maybe more specifically just about how church operates. Mm. But then it started to really make a shift, I think, as it relates to worldview and beliefs. So, as we have gone through this process, and fortunately we've stayed pretty closely together in all of it. Mm. We've had multiple moments where we just look at each other and we're like, what do we tell our kids about God? Our older son, Jad, because he was born before the deconstruct happened. So we had some of these like very practical, like, we're going to pray before we have our meal. Mm-hmm, so there's still some defaults that he even goes to now that he's five, where we'll be sitting down to eat. And for Lindsay and I, that's just not something we do anymore, but he'll be like, all right, it's time to pray. And we don't shut them down, but there is this feeling that like we look at each other across the table and we're like, it's like, are we supposed to say something? Like maybe we don't need to say this prayer anymore, but we just kind of let it slide. But because I think part of it is we just don't even know how to talk about God, about faith, about church with our kids anymore.
So one of my questions that emerges as you talk is like, how much of your deconstruction process actually emerged as a result of now being a parent, which is sometimes what I see from some people, that when you're single or married without kids, there's a different set of questions that you wrestle with. And as soon as kids show up, there's a whole other set of questions that you're now wrestling with that almost provokes a further deconstruction. I've heard somebody say, well, you know, I was wrestling with this. I'm not quite sure. And then the kid showed up. And then I heard this person say, I do not want to teach this to my kids.
Yeah, so that is so true.
It pushed further. So I'd be curious how much of your journey was actually catalyzed or pushed as a result of you having kids.
I think I'll speak for Lindsay first, because I would say for her, it has been very central to the conversation, because there's so much where like we'll be like batting around a different idea. And she'd be like, So now how do we talk about this with our kids? What do we say to our kids? Like, it comes back to that place in a very practical level of, we have to be able to share about this with our family. Mm. Where I kind of maybe, I get kind of stuck in my own head a lot of times, without thinking about those kind of implications. So I'd say that for her. And then for me, that's been great because she kind of pulls me along in that of like, no, this is a bigger thing for our entire family of like, what is the heritage, or what are we going to pass on to our kids? Mm-hmm. Cause we want to pass on something meaningful, but it sometimes feels like as you deconstruct, you don't have language anymore.
Right.
Mm-hmm. To talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to give me all the language now, right? Is that what's going
to. Okay. So one of the things that comes to mind as we talk is that that's absolutely, I mean, I have great compassion for that situation, because when you don't know who you are, you feel this responsibility, and as you should, for your children, and you want them to have the very best life. Yeah. I can imagine that most people listening to this want them to actually have a faith that is meaningful. I can't imagine that you would have an audience that is listening that wants to raise atheist kids, because
haven't gotten any messages from them yet.
Yeah. So if you're listening to the Voices podcast, then there's still something either attractive or still something drawing or compelling, but the way and the framework and the language is just not doing it for you anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's just, and it can't, because it's you can't substantiate it anymore. It's the substance has been lost. So one of the first things that comes to mind is parents can alleviate themselves from the, I guess, responsibility of doing that, because guess what? Your parents right now, your parents, Gary, are they responsible for your faith development?
Nope.
So in many ways, what you're experiencing now can actually be initiated fairly soon, fairly early. We just think that as kids are younger, we have a responsibility to give them, which if you think about it, is part of the proclamational platform that we're trying to deconstruct from. Like one of the ways that some people deconstruct is like, you know, I sit in a pew and I hear and I listen. I'm supposed to take in, I'm supposed to believe, and then I'm supposed to regurgitate, right? That's kind of the process that we all have grown up in. And part of the deconstruction, part of what you're trying to do with your podcast is invoke more conversations, inquiry, discovery, right? Well, that previous platform emerges into parenting as well. I'm responsible for now giving a lecture to my child, or to let them believe certain things, or to use certain language for their faith system. And part of the alleviation of that is like, just stop doing that and start having more conversations and listening carefully to them. Listen carefully to them. One of my parenting principles, I don't know how scientifically valid this is just simply pay attention. Just pay attention to what your kids are doing. So you mentioned your son wanting to pray.
Yeah.
Support that. It means something to him.
Okay.
And it not only for you, it means something theologically. For him, it means something familial. Right? Okay. You can't pray in the same way anymore, because your relationship with God is very different.
Yep.
He wants to pray in that way because his relationship with you is still the same. And that praying means something to him regarding the family. So I would just listen and pay attention to how he responds to that. Phoebe does the same thing. She prays. I will tell you, maybe I shouldn't tell you. I just don't anymore in the same way. Can I whisper this?
Less people will hear it.
Exactly. Less people will listen if I whisper. The whole, I guess the compulsion to pray in the same way. Why? Because I read Jesus, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Oh, this prayer is like a reinvigoration of your identity, not necessarily just some sort of ritual that you're supposed to perform before every single meal. So I've been informed by that, right? So I've been transformed by that. But for my daughter, she loves it and it's meaningful to her. And she will go through her own development of what it means as she grows older. The goal, I guess, as I think about it, as she grows older, is not to constantly imbue within her the right theology or the right ways of thinking, but to be a co-sojourner with her on her process of discovery. So that means paying attention to where she's going, and I get to travel alongside with her in that. So if she believes that God is love right now, then I get to be there with her in that. And then later on, she says, I think God is actually distant. I would call her a deist at that particular point. she wouldn't have the language for that. And said, but, you know, why do all these bad things happen, right? I'm anticipating that question as she gets older.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're right. That is a fantastic question. Why don't we ask that question together? But I don't want to ask that question for her. I want her to ask that question, and then I get to be with her in that question.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, that was... I'm getting emotional. Really, I am, because I'm just thinking about some... I'm picturing some of those conversations down the road with my kids, and I think... I can think of moments even with Lindsay and I. So, going way back, I remember when she first tossed out the idea of, like, I don't know if the whole thing about Jesus dying on the cross is like that leads to forgiveness of sins for every single person.
Right, right.
I mean, this was when I was very locked into a mega church evangelical place. And my attitude to her was like, what's wrong with you?
Mm.
How could you question such a doctrine that is so fundamental to, this one we were dating at the time, but I was the guy ready to defend and protect this thing.
Yeah.
And so now I'm thinking about when that happens with my kids, like what happens when, they do have some of those questions. I would hope I have this posture of welcoming it, including that, rather than shutting it down,
mm-hmm.
you know? So that what you said is so beautiful, this idea of being on the journey with them and letting those things come out in the timing that they're going to come out.
I consider it a ministry. Kids are such a blessing because they are ministers to us. They are re-inviting us into the space of what it means to be a child, something that we have completely forgotten. Mm-hmm. And now if you read, you know, Jesus in Matthew 18, you know, let the little children come. And by the way, you're not going to be able to enter into the kingdom of God unless you enter into it like a child.
Yeah.
And so by allowing our children to lead us in that particular sense, we are perhaps becoming more attuned with what the movement of Jesus is in establishing the kingdom on earth. Like
mm-hmm.
that level of humility, that level of wonder, that level of even faith and certainty. And I know as soon as I use that word certainty, because all of your people have listened to Pete Enns and have read his books, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Certainty is perhaps dysfunctional when it's misplaced in areas that do not require or do not demand certainty. Theology is not an area that demands certainty, but your son needs to be certain about his love of you and your love of him. So certainty is actually a really good value. It's just been in this deconstruction phase, it's been misplaced into something that doesn't fall into the same category. It's a category mix, mismatch in the way that I would estimate it. So him being loved by God, but, or that there is a love in this universe that welcomes him, that, you know, that kind of thing. Celebrate that. And that's okay to actually have that certainty at that particular age. And don't ruin it for him when he's 7 and 8. You know, it's like, well, I'm glad you feel certain now, son, but let me tell you, it's going to get a whole lot worse from here. You know, it's like,
oh, no, yeah.
And that's what I mean by just be present with him in that particular moment. Because as you know, as we all know, there is plenty of darkness and sin and disruption and pain and tragedy and betrayal that is coming for them. So what they need to know is that there's a certainty in the relationship that they have with you. And that's a good thing. And part of that certainty comes from, I'm just going to sit. You believe that God is up there and you believe that God loves you and you believe that dying on the cross for you is somehow meaningful for you right now in that moment, son, that's beautiful. And I hope that you know that that love will always be true for you. Mm. And I'm sure some in your audience might think that that's a little bit too much. And I would say that's okay. You can't be inauthentic to yourself as well.
Yeah.
But there is something beautiful and freeing and life-giving about letting your children lead you. letting your children be your ministers, letting your children be the sage in your household. Well, you just heard from our little one how she was hearing the story of Herod and the snake in the garden. And on her own, she said to us, oh, Herod and the snake are on the same team.
Yeah, yeah.
And I will tell you, I have never put it that way before. And I was like, oh, that's so brilliant. Love it. Yeah. You put something together that was of ministry to me. Now, I'm not going to get into some sort of deep theology about how the serpent is not Satan and Herod is of a different time era. And so, you know, how dare you put that together like that? You
know? Yeah.
That is so anecdotal, and that, you know, shame on you. You know, I'm not going to do that. But yeah, there's something beautiful in that I want to hold on to.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm rambling.
No, you're good. Because a couple of things you said kind of tweaked me, so I need you to explain.
Okay, let's go there.
Okay, so first off, this idea. Let me give both of them to you. That kind of, I need a different way to think about it, I think. So first off, prayer. So you're saying that impulse in our kids to want to pray, like, don't shut it down. Don't be like, oh, don't do that, because we, theologically, I don't know if that's the accurate way to understand prayer, that God is just sitting waiting for you to ask for the thing and then he'll give you the thing, right?
Right.
Like, I think that's what my brain does. And I'm like, okay, how do I, maybe one is shut my way of reasoning through that with my kids. And then also it feels like, isn't that destructive in some way to start training your child to think a certain way about a God above that, as long as you ask for the right things, then he'll give you what you want. We always combat that in church, and we say, like, no, God's not the cosmic, like, soda machine, or whatever analogies we use, that you can't just come to God and be like, hey, I want this and I want that. But in some way, are we teaching our kids that? Okay. So that's one thing I'm thinking about. And then some of these very fundamental ideas about the Christian faith. So as you mentioned, like the cross, that being something that really means something to your child. I have a hard time thinking about my kid hearing about the cross in their 3-year-old classroom at church of Jesus died for you on the cross, or like however that story is told in that classroom. To me, there's this part of me that goes like, I don't know if I want them to hear that yet. I don't know if I want them to hear what I guess I perceive as that's such a violent thing that I think has been misunderstood in the Christian church for a long time, that God needed blood, that God needed these things in order to love, right? So there's part of me that wonders, like, is that damaging to them to let them just believe these certain things that at some point we're going to say, hey, you need to transcend that. But could it cause them to just run and be like, well, how come nobody told me the truth? How come nobody told me the nuance? Right? So that happens a lot with people.
Yeah. The first thing that comes to mind, I think, in answer to you, or in response to your first inquiry, is very much like hermeneutics, very much like exegesis, very much like trying to understand what the Bible is. You first have to start the question, what did it mean to them, not what does it mean to you?
Okay.
And I would apply that same question in your situation about prayer. When your son needs, wants to pray, your question should not be, what does it mean to you, but what does it mean to him?
Okay.
And whatever it means to him, that's where you meet him in that particular place. And absolutely, you're still the parent in the sense that I think we all have the prerogative to guide, to teach, to shape, to mold. I would say you do that much more through your presence than through your words, like how the posture of your body, the energy that you create in the home. And then the words supplement that in a particular way. But by just simply listening to what does it mean to him is a really good question to ask, because it helps you, again, just simply pay attention to what's going on with your child.
Okay.
The other thing that came to mind is prayer for you, again, is theological, and prayer for him may simply be ritual. And we all, every single one of us, need rituals. How you get up in the morning, how you go to bed at night, Christmas, Easter, seasons, times. Rituals ground us in meaning and purpose. The reason why when you got married, I would imagine there was some sort of ceremony, flowers, dress, ring. None of that has absolutely anything to do with being married, but the ritual means something. And the ritual actually draws other people in to relive that ritual. So the people that attended your wedding that were already married, they're not attending your wedding. They are also attending their wedding over again. It is a reestablishment of the community. Now, we see this anthropologically and sociologically all throughout history. We redo all of these rituals because it has meaning for us. And I would say there's nothing wrong with that. I'm sure that there's some people that would say there's a whole bunch of things wrong with that, which is your second half of the question.
Yeah.
But so I'll get there in just a second. But at the very base of it, from a fundamental anthropological, sociological, and spiritual standpoint, having those rituals is really grounding. One of my favorite authors on parenting, Lawrence Steinberg, wrote a book, The 10 Basic Principles of Good Parenting. I might get the phraseology a little bit wrong, but I think I recall him saying that his very first one, by the way, is you can never be too loving. That's his very first principle. And then the second principle is always be consistent. Just be consistent. And having consistency, not only in your attitude, in your posture, but also in your time frame and your logistics and your schedule, is actually very grounding and creates actually a security in people. It creates a security in your child. Part of the reason why some of us who are deconstructing find ourselves now lost, right? I hear this fairly frequently that you've deconstructed, you've abandoning all the rituals.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of people in my community who now just don't know who they are anymore. Like, consider that. Think about that.
Yeah.
Of course you don't. You've just left something that has grounded you in an identity. Now, you don't like the things that that ritual is attributed to, or the teachings or the theology. That's fine. But oftentimes people abandon the ritual with it, and then you're lost. So part of the challenge of deconstruction is recreating the rituals, recreating the traditions, recreating that identity through those behavioral practices. For a child, those behavioral practices are really grounding. They're really meaningful and really purposeful.
Well, that reminds me, I'm reading a book by Frank Schaeffer right now. And it's kind of memoir-esque, but one of the things, actually, one of the chapters I read last night was he talked about how he sometimes doesn't really even know why he goes to church still.
Right.
Other than it feels like it was ingrained to him because he grew up in the religious right movement, that it's like he feels guilty if he's not there. Mm-hmm. But he talks about like bringing his grandkids, and what he points out, and I thought was so beautiful, was he said, church is still a place that I think helps my grandkids see that there's more to the world than being rich, doing life on your own, taking care of self. That church still provides this kind of value in his life. So I found that very interesting, because it wasn't because he's going because I want to make sure I keep hearing the right belief, that I make sure, okay, oh yeah, I still believe the right thing, so I know where I'm going when I die. But right. It's like, this actually has a very practical value to my family.
There's a shared story. There's a shared value set. There's a lot of things that cause us to find great direction in life as a result of that. It sounds to me like what may perhaps be happening is that if you're attending church primarily for what they teach and preach from a belief standpoint, then of course you're going to have to abandon church when you no longer believe those things.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But as you mentioned, church, ecclesia, or ecclesia, depending upon how you want to pronounce that, in its original iteration was people gathering together, and of the items that they gathered together, the apostles' teaching was only one of them. Fellowship, breaking of bread, prayer. There were so many other elements that were grounding and central to the identity of the community, and the apostles' teaching was only one of them. And by the way, the apostles' teachings were not the theological constructs that we have. The apostles' teachings were, how do we now live out this way of Jesus in our new context under the rule of Trajan or Domitian or Titus, right? Now that the temple's gone, how do we live out this way? So it wasn't like an indoctrination. It was like, how do we live?
Yeah.
How now do we live? So yeah, I resonate very much with that idea that, and I don't know how public I should be. I am a pastor of a church and I don't believe half the things that come out of my mouth, right? the things that I say. But I also go because the people there are grounding for me.
Yeah. That's
and so the true. Community. And so now to your second part, yep. What if they're teaching atonement theology, or what if they're teaching things that are maybe admittedly abhorrent or destructive or damaging? What do you do with that? Well, the same thing that you would do with any other development along with a child. At least this is the first thought that comes to mind. You sit with them in that as well. Hmm. And you ask questions. The part of the deconstruction process, part of the Voices podcast, is people who are asking deeper questions or reimagining. Hmm. Well, guess what? Jesus died for you. Let's just take that phrase. Jesus died for you. Read the scriptures. Jesus did die for you. What is the death? Well, it's not the same atonement theology thing, but Jesus did die.
Yeah.
For, well, yeah, there for is a word that means purpose. There was some sort of goal. There was some sort of meaning behind that death. It's not the same atonement theology. You, who is the you? Well, the you can be both, in English, it's beautiful, individual, singular, and communal, plural. So, you can still hold on to some of that language and ask deeper questions and allow your child, or to prompt your child, like, you know what? That's wonderful that you learned that. What do you think that means? Mm. Tell me more about what else the teacher said. Does that make sense to you? What does that tell you about the nature of God? And the more and more you ask these questions, the more and more you're inviting your child into the very same process of deconstruction that you are going through, which is simply by asking questions. The problem, well, the difference is he's not deconstructing, he's constructing, except you're now giving him the grounding. Now, the implication of the tagline of your questions, like, isn't that damaging and won't people leave? Absolutely, there's a risk in this, but I have perceived, and I could be wrong on this, but I have perceived that people leave not because they don't believe the things that they were taught anymore. People leave because they were never allowed to think in church in the first place, okay. And they wanted a place where they could think. I do believe that people leave not because we haven't trained them well enough, but because we have lied to them in a certain way. But it's not that we have lied to them theologically. We've lied to them in our posture. This is the truth. That's the lie. The lie is that we have... There's another church actually around here that I was just hearing about that has essentially perpetuated the myth that if you were not baptized in our church, then you're not saved, right? That wow. That still exists. And I'm in Silicon Valley here, right?
Yeah, progressive part of the country.
So
yeah.
So that still exists. Well, the lie is not that if you're not, I don't know, I mean, you could parse this all sorts of different ways. You should be baptized. I mean, that's part of the tradition. It's part of the ritual. It means something to you, right? Mm-hmm. It holds meaning. And it's part of a ritual and a tradition that goes back thousands of years that we all get to participate in. We get to find our community with all of the previous people that have been baptized. And we find connection and intimacy and identity in that. But we have lied to them in the sense that that is the only way and that our truth is the only truth. Here's a more honest way of saying it. We believe of this baptism, and you need to be baptized, and we hope that you do it within our church. But you know what? God is a big God, and we may have it wrong. Just that small posture of humility is what is missing, because we have to be the gatekeepers. So I could be wrong. I would love to hear feedback from your audience, because I'm personally on this journey of wanting to learn and understand more as well. But I don't think if you really do the soul searching, I don't think you've left because they taught you things that were important. I think people left because you were not allowed to be yourself, to ask questions, to think about things differently in that context. And you were branded on the outside and a heretic if you thought differently. I bet you could still go to a church where the pastor taught something different from what you believe. If the culture of the church was, and you are welcome if you don't believe the same thing.
Yeah.
We're just really glad you're here because you bring something to the community. I apologize again for being self-referential. I am trying to do that with Spark, or with the guests that I'm bringing. I will tell you, the guests that I bring, I don't agree with everything that they say. But I'm not trying to bring people that are going to buttress what we already believe. I'm trying to bring people that will challenge us and push us and show my congregation that if you don't believe what I believe, guess what? You're still welcome. And not only are you welcome, you are needed because, gosh darn it, I don't have it all right.
Yeah.
And you challenging me as quote unquote the pastor of the church is so healthy for our congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And my congregation knows that they can disagree. I've had actually several people get up and walk out of some of my sermons because they couldn't believe what I was saying.
Really?
And they're still a part of our community. And I had a conversation with one of them and she said, you know what? You were saying this and I just felt like you were so off. But I also know that this is a place where you allow tension and conversation and argument.
Yeah.
And she is just as integrated into the life of our church as she has ever been, even though that one message that I gave was really offensive to her.
Yeah.
It was, and I will tell you from an emotional standpoint, that was hard because obviously I don't want to do that for my people. And then on the other hand, I celebrated. I was like, yes, we're getting there.
Yeah.
I have a congregant, who is vehemently against abortion. And I will tell you that I have very diverse views on the issue. It is an extremely complicated one for me.
Yeah.
From a spiritual standpoint, I am very conservative, actually. That would probably surprise some people because of the way I talk. But I'm actually very conservative on the issue, even though I might be a little bit more progressive on the politics of it, right? So it's a very complicated issue for me. But he has said to me, I just need to hear my pastor say that abortion is killing babies and it's just wrong all the time. That's what he needs his pastor to say. And I said, well, I think I very much resonate with your sentiment, but I don't know if you'll ever hear me say that.
Yeah.
And he knows that this is a obviously a very divisive issue, very challenging one. And well, I might have just gotten you in trouble by mentioning it on your podcast now, but he also knows that I need that voice in my life. And as soon as I get rid of that voice in my life, I am worse off. I have now created my own echo chamber. I have now created my own bubble. I have now created my own boundary set and my own idol. I need his voice in my life. So how did we get there? I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't know.
So I think it would be the same thing in extrapolating that to raising your kids. They need to understand and they need the skill set for how to deal with different voices and different views and different theologies and not castigate people just simply because they believe something different.
Mm-hmm.
They need to learn how to interrogate it all. And this is where you as the parent are actually a disciple maker. You get to model that for them. You get to model gracious, compassionate inquiry, question, and interrogation of all views.
Mm-hmm.
You get to model that for them. And as long as your child, this is what I believe so far, as long as your child knows that it is safe to be exactly who they are and to ask any questions that they want, well, I don't think you'll have to be terribly afraid to allow them to learn certain things. That's okay.
Yeah.
I think that's okay. Phoebe asked the other day, does Jesus have Jesus in his heart?
Wow, what a question. Yeah. Oh,
and I did not answer her. I said, sweetheart, that is a beautiful question. Let's think about that. What would that mean? How would that work? And what does it then mean for us to have Jesus in our heart? So I did, at least my posture is not to correct her, not to tell her that she just doesn't understand abstract thinking.
Yeah.
And hand her Plato's, some Platonic literature and say, you know, you need to read Plato here.
As a 3-year-old.
Yeah. So, hold it, embrace it, relish it, celebrate it, and journey with them.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of that was helpful, but
yeah.
Just spitballing here. So,
well, you've talked a little bit about with me, this, idea of like, kind of just going off what you just said, raising a child is discipleship.
Yeah.
It is making disciples. Talk a little bit about that. Even coming from your own lens, if you've done so much study on like ancient Hebrew culture and I mean, what they did with their kids and maybe what translates to us.
Okay.
Now.
So this is fascinating. This is so fascinating. William Barclay wrote a book, Educational Ideals in the Ancient World. And he compared essentially Greek culture, Roman culture, Babylonian culture, Israelite culture. In sum, he says, no culture in the ancient world valued the education of their children more than the Hebrews, more than the Israelites.
Okay.
Now, you can go to Josephus. You can go to the Talmud, which is later, but it pulls in traditions from much earlier. And then you take a look at some of the passages in the Bible that allude to the system. There was a system of discipleship in the ancient world. Some people have actually made this system a little bit popular, known as, you know, walking in the dust of the rabbi and stuff like that. But anyway,
yeah.
Discipleship is essentially you modeling a particular way, and you would do so not by teaching, but by living. And the disciple calls the rabbi essentially your father. You are born again. And you would go through these particular schools. And as you get older and older, oh, speaking of disciple, I think the family's
home. Oh, look, home. Yeah.
as you would get older and older and older through this process, the goal was not to learn what the teacher knew. The goal was to become what the teacher is.
Okay.
So discipleship is all about modeling what kind of life you're living rather than just learning or knowing what the rabbi knows.
Yeah. Okay.
That, my friend, is a brilliant way of parenting because it's not about what you're trying to teach your children. It's all about what kind of life are you trying to live and will your children live, watch, model after you in that same way. The classic hilarious example is this. A child hits another kid on the playground. And what do? You go up to them and you slap them on the hand and say, we don't hit in this family.
Yeah. Wow. The irony, right?
I see that happen fairly frequently.
Yeah. It's pretty common. Mm-hmm.
That is discipleship. You have just taught your child, you do hit in this family, even though your words say the opposite. Discipleship is that framework for putting the emphasis, not on what you're teaching your children, but how you yourself are actually living.
Oh, man. That's a huge shift.
Yeah, it's a brilliant way of thinking about it, which now flips parenting on its head. I've been to so many parenting seminars, which is all about how to change your child, to create systems that will get their behavior to shift.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time I sit there, I go, what are the parents doing? How are they behaving?
Yeah.
And the parents that are the most grounded, the parents that are the least anxious, the parents that are the most passionate, those are the parents that succeed well because they know who they are and they're attempting to live in a certain way and the children essentially pick that up, you know.
Yeah.
Discipleship is caught, not taught, as to put it in a really pithy way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
The famous saying from Perkei Avot, which is a tractate in the Talmud, is, may you be covered in the dust of your rabbi, and may you drink in his words as if you were very thirsty. Being covered in the dust of the rabbi has become that phraseology to mean you are following so close to your rabbi that you're covered in the dust that he kicks up. That's how close you want to be, so that you emulate, you follow, you model your life after your rabbi. Mm. One of the funny stories is, you know, there's a prayer for everything in Judaism. Is there a prayer for going to the bathroom? And the answer is, yes, there is. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, for creating holes in our bodies.
Seriously?
Seriously. So wow. That's the blessing. And as a disciple, you would actually follow your rabbi into the bathroom to observe how does he bless and honor God, even in this.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's how close you want to be.
Yeah.
So your children are actually that close to you. So focusing on your children is really not as important as focusing on yourself. How are you behaving?
Mm-hmm.
My little one just had a yelling tantrum, not a tantrum, but just yelled at the top of her lungs. She was so frustrated. And my wife, I loved it. She picked her up and calmly held her and said, honey, do we yell in this house?
Mm.
Yeah. What would that be like if daddy yelled at you? What would that be like if mommy yelled at you? And you could see the wheels turning like, yeah, she just did something that mommy and daddy don't do. But what we so frequently do is as soon as our child, stop yelling.
Right? Yeah, yeah, stop exactly.
Yelling.
By yelling at them.
By yelling at them. this is a very common parenting faux pas that happens all the time. So part of the lens of discipleship teaches us to pay more attention to how we ourselves are living. And then pick up parenting techniques along the way. Absolutely. I mean, those parenting books are wonderful and helpful, and or at least the ones that are helpful are wonderful. All the rest of them are crap. But it absolutely, it doesn't mean you're not learning parenting techniques or strategies. It just simply means that a spiritually grounded way is to really focus upon your own soul. I think I mentioned this to you before. 90% of all parenting is just managing your own anxiety and your own fear. And I hear a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety, and that manifests itself. And then I will tell you, the family system picks up on that. And your children will learn how to be anxious and fearful. So focusing on yourself sounds very selfish, but it just simply means you're modeling your lifestyle. That is what is probably most important in raising your kids. So we are attempting to do that. And I tell you, it's life-giving for me. I'm just not anxious anymore about it. And that goes to the theology too. I'm not anxious about it. My child learned something in Sunday school, and, you know, we obviously, I'm the pastor. I've hired the person who's teaching my child, you know, so I have a comfort level there, but even some things that he might say, in Sunday school, I might not agree with. No anxiety. It's like, oh, okay. Well, that's what Pastor Mark said. That's great. You know, what do you think about that?
Okay.
Does that make sense? Well, let's read the Bible ourselves and figure it out for ourselves. And what do you think? Right. A very Socratic method, but also a very discipleship method of allowing the child to perceive the world on their own terms. And I get to journey again. We're saying this over and over again, but journey with them in that process. So,
yeah. Now, I only have a few more questions. And what I'd love to hear you talk about is, are there any like sacred rituals that you in your family are practicing that kind of help center you guys and just are things that you return back to? I mean, is there anything you kind of pass on and say like, here's some ideas? Cause I think that's, you know, that's some of what the tangible, the parent that's out there listening is looking for, like, okay, what are some of those practical things that maybe I could start to begin doing other than what we've already talked about?
Because we've been influenced by the Jewish tradition, we do Shabbat. We sing songs. We've kind of gotten out of the habit recently, but my wife makes challah, and Phoebe participates in the making of that. It's a wonderful ritual. She gets to drink grape juice, sparkling grape juice on Shabbat. And then we have a book party or a popcorn party, and it's family time. That's about the only ritual that we have other than church on Sunday. We have a ritual for every night that we go to bed. And I would say, as I say that, rituals are not spiritual. Rituals can be spiritual.
Okay.
But rituals are brushing your teeth, getting dressed, putting the PJs on, walking out the door a certain way, having particular classes throughout the week at certain times. She knows when it's dance class, when it's this class. And after that, we go for pizza. That's a ritual.
Yeah.
And that's a grounding ritual because it's something that's a shared space and a shared experience between the parent and the child. So, maybe a very mundane way of saying it is that a ritual is just simply a schedule. This is what we do at this time, at this place. And we imbue each and every activity with meaning. She has a dance class, and then afterwards they go for pizza, and then they go to this other class afterwards. And I met them for lunch in between. And when I walked up to the table, there was a pizza on the table, and my wife was reading a book and she was reading a book. And I just fell in love all over again. It's like, there they are, they're reading books. And then so daddy pulled up his chair and I started reading my book. Now we're not doing anything quote unquote together, but Phoebe knows that in our house, we read books.
Guys, you're not here with us right now. There are books literally everywhere.
So
it's amazing.
She knows, right? That's part of who we are. That's part of how, and she's starting to love books more and more and more and more. So that's part of the ritual as well. We read books every night before we go to bed. She gets to pick two or three, and they get more advanced. And now we get chapter books, and she actually asks for Bible stories from this little beginner's Bible, which is theologically horrendous. But we read the stories.
Okay.
Because they're the stories. And in this story, the one we read last night, It's David and Goliath. And by the way, because we're geeks, and I know this is going to sound very pretentious, but we don't say Goliath. We say Goliath and David. That's how we pronounce the names.
Yeah.
So Goliath was in the Valley of Elah, you know, so we're reading these stories. And we tell her, she's like, Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the whale. And I said, Phoebe, was it a whale? And she goes, no, it was a big fish. I said, okay, it was a big fish. It was not a whale. There's no whale in the book of Jonah. So we do some indoctrination.
Yeah, yeah. some correction there.
But in the book, Goliath is lying on his back after he was hit with a stone. And in your Bible, Goliath is laying on his front. He falls face down. That's really important to the theological concept of the story.
Really?
But I'm reading the story with her, and there's the picture of Goliath on his back. And I just pointed to the story and I said, and Phoebe, just to let you know, when, you know, as you read this story, Goliath actually falls face down, which is a posture of worship. That's all part of the narrative, what they're trying to construct in that story in 1 Samuel 17. So we do some of that. So even though I completely disagree with the image that is there, we can bring them along. And then if she was literate, the way that I would do it in accordance with the philosophy that I've mentioned earlier is like, question, what do you like about this picture? What you don't like about this picture? What about this picture matches with what the Bible says, and what doesn't it match with the Bible? So rather than me telling her that this is wrong, she's only three now, so I kind of have to do a little bit of that. But in later years, I would say, what do you say?
Yeah.
And let's compare it. Why do you think why do you think the authors and the illustrators would have done that? Why? And then now you're developing a whole other skill set with them that I think would be for them to see. My dream is for her to be in high school or college and to be the kid that the teacher hates because she's constantly raising her hand and saying, wait a second, that doesn't make
any
sense.
Hold on a second.
Right?
Yep.
And that's ultimately what I want for her. I want her to be that confident in her question skills and her analytical skills to be able to say, and then to be able to sit in church and go, excuse me, yeah. Pastor. Dad,
you missed it.
That's wrong. So
yeah, well, and it sounds like a lot of the onus is then on the parent there to actually, I mean, even like you've talked about a little bit today, to really be living it and embracing it. Because if you, like for me, I didn't even know that that's about Goliath.
Right,
he falls on his face. Right. You know, so for me, I wouldn't even think to point that out.
Right,
but so for me, it makes me go to this place of, okay, I want to make sure that I'm somebody who's fully engaged in my spirituality, in my walk of faith, that I can actually point out some of the little nuances along the way. And again, walk alongside in that journey.
So this might be a really beautiful kind of capstone on all of this.
Yeah.
Is that that's exactly what kids can do for you, right? Mm. They have just catalyzed just what you've just explained. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is a beautiful, wonderful journey. You want to rediscover something beautiful about your faith, and you want to pass that beauty on to your children. When you're deconstructing, sometimes the only thing that you can see are the things that disgust you, that repulse you.
Yeah, I can get stuck there,
right?
For sure.
But kids can catalyze a different way of viewing that there's something beautiful, there's something wonderful to be discovered. And if it leads you to starting all over again, beautiful. Start all over again. Just scrap the whole deal, right? Read Genesis 1 again like you've never read it before.
Yeah.
Or don't, because when we were kids, we didn't read Genesis 1. That's not how we came to faith. We came to faith because we involved ourselves with a community or with worship or with a ritual like baptism or something like that, right? There's all sorts of different ways in which you can start over. But that's what kids are doing.
Yeah.
They're starting over and they're causing us to start over, which may be the very point Jesus is saying when he talks about this in Matthew 18. Start over again.
Okay, let's end it on this. For the people out there that are like, give me resources. Tell me a couple of your favorite books or, I don't know, websites, whatever it might be that might be helpful as a
parent. On parenting specifically?
Yeah, parenting.
I already mentioned Lawrence Steinberg's book, 10 Basic Principles of Good Parenting. That's one I have recommended. He's not a Christian, but it's just a kind of child psychologist, sociologist who's identified some key principles, and they're very, very helpful. I haven't finished. I only just started How to Raise an Adult. But so far I'm liking, she's going through a little bit of some of the things that have been very challenging for us. She begins with talking about the fear.
Who is this?
Her name is Julie Lithcott-Hames, How to Raise an Adult. And she talks about the factors such as, let's say, the milk carton kids and the America's Most Wanted and the perception that we have that our world is more fearful and that has caused us to kind of become much more protectionistic. But as a result of that, we're not raising kids that have the same level of resilience. Again, I've only just started it, so I don't know how it's going to ultimately turn out, but so far I like the thesis of it. And ultimately our world is actually more safer. More safer? Dear Lord. More safe. And then the one that, is not accessible to everybody because it's very, heavy and thick, regarding its content would be, Edwin Friedman's books and work. The book that I'm referred to earlier is A Failure of Nerve.
Okay.
And then his book for counselors and pastors is called Generation to Generation. His basic thesis is the non-anxious presence that, we basically bring our anxiety to a social system. A family is a social system.
Yeah.
And we bring our anxiety to that. And that anxiety is then reflected upon by other people that only exacerbates more anxiety.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like the swirly of doom of anxiety. So he posits that we need what he calls a self-differentiated presence, a self-differentiation from that anxiety. In other words, that your anxiety is not going to bother me in the same way.
Okay.
It's kind of like boundaries, but it's a whole other level of an emotional set than just boundaries as a practical reality. And his work has been, I think, very, very helpful for me in framing, because I know I bring my own anxiety. I already talked about the beginning of the podcast, the anxiety that I bring from my broken home and stuff like that. So I've had to deal with all of that. Excuse me. Those are some
great
potential resources on parenting that may or may not be helpful. So,
yeah. Right on, Kev. Well, this has been great. It really has. I mean, even just for my own, I mean, this is what I'm living. I'm living with a 5 and a 3-year-old and trying to understand how do I pass on something that I really, I don't know if the right word is believe in, but something that I want our family to be known for, and I want to continue on with my kids. So this has been really helpful, honestly, for me.
Awesome.
And I know for our family. So I'm excited to talk to Lindsay about it and for other people to hear it. So thanks for spending some time with us today.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Gary.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of the Voices Podcast. If you want to get the links for anything we talked about today, they will be in the show notes on patreon.com/voicespodcast. If you go there, you can scroll down to the episode and you will see all the links right there.
And if you're interested in becoming a supporter of the show, we are on Patreon. So you can go to our Patreon website and you'll see different levels of supporting the show. That helps us to get different guests on the show, put more time and resources to this. And one of the things we want to do is be a resource to you on your spiritual journey. That was the whole vision behind this in the first place. So one of those ways we do that is at different levels, there are different resources that we'll make available to you as you are working through reimagining faith.
We also want you to be able to join the conversation with us. So make sure you leave us a comment on Facebook or tweet at us on Twitter. We are Voices Podcast on Facebook and at Voices Pod on Twitter. Let us know what you thought, agreed with, disagreed with, and what you want to hear more about.
All right. Thanks for listening.